Thanks for listening to this episode of PageCast, brought to you by Jonathan Ball Publishers. From award-winning non-fiction writer Hedley Twidell comes Show Me the Place, an essay collection searching through history, memory, and literature to find glimmers of utopia. The collection is a book of elsewheres. In it, the author charts a journey to find other livable places and spaces in a troubled world. Whether embarking on a bizarre quest to find Cecil Rhodes' missing nose, sliced off in the bust of Rhodes Memorial, or bikepacking the Scottish Islands with a couple of squabbling anarchists. Whether learning to surf, much too late, in the wild, freezing waters off the Cape Peninsula, or navigating the fraught politics of a Buddhist retreat center, the author explores forgotten utopias, intentional communities, and islands of imagination with curiosity, hope, and humor. Threaded through the pieces in this collection are questions of friendship and human community, of environmental destruction and despair, of landscape and memory. In this episode, Hedley is in conversation with Mila de Villiers, Sunday Times Books digital editor. Enjoy.
Morning, everyone. I'm Mila de Villiers, the editor of the Sunday Times of Book website. And today I'm speaking to essayist and academic Hedley Twidell about his latest collection of essays, Show Me the Place. Hedley, hello.
Hi, Mila. How are you doing?
Well, thanks, and you. This collection, it covers quite a vast portion of your life, even including schoolboy anecdotes. What makes you remember?
Yeah, thanks, Mila. Yes, it does. Actually, I was thinking that some of the pieces in the book, for example, memories of traveling and bikepacking in Scottish Islands, I started writing them, I don't know, maybe 15 years ago. And they've been just slowly developing for a long time. So, what does make one remember? I mean, that's a good question, because a lot of the book is about memory and it's about what it means to re-inhabit places from one's life. And I suppose that this book, it sort of began to coalesce into a book during the COVID years, which I sort of try not to mention because I think everyone's sick of it, but it's kind of shadows the book, because I think at that time, a lot of us were stuck at her home, obviously, and we had to find other places to inhabit emotionally, aesthetically. And I think we all had, or many of us had, a desperate desire to be elsewhere or other than where we were. And so I think there was a kind of mental travel that began in earnest then, which was both into memory, into places that I'd been and places where actually I'd been happy, which is actually a very difficult thing to write about. And then also places, you know, imaginary places, literature, science fiction, other worlds, utopias. So it's definitely a project that began with the question of memory.
It's now that you mentioned the imagined alternatives and novels especially, you extensively draw on the work of Ursula Le Guin. I mean, you're quite the fanboy.
Well, you know, to be honest, I'm not a sci-fi person and I never was an SF buff. I'd read Le Guin's, Earthsea trilogy as a kid. And then I was sort of loosely working on this project, and I would say to people, I'm kind of interested in utopias and, you know, real utopias, not utopias that are actually dystopias, but believably, plausibly better worlds than our own. And then people kept saying to me, you've got to read The Dispossessed by Ursula Le Guin. You've got to read The Dispossessed. And then I read it, and it was also during the lockdown, and it just hit me so hard, this novel. I was floored by it, and it brought me so much solace. And I became fascinated with her. I spent so much time in her company. And, you know, for those who haven't read it, I mean, essentially it's her attempt to imagine what she called an anarchist utopia. You know, so the problem with most utopian literary projects, or most writers who've tried to imagine utopias or better worlds, is that they tend to become very authoritarian. There's always some world, state, or party or leader who begins to institute their version of what's good, and the people who don't like it tend to be put in the gulag, you know, or in prison. So Le Guin is trying to get away from that whole tradition and write an anarchist utopia, i.e. a utopia without a state, without a ruler, without party politics, without an economy, without a police force, without an army. And she imagines this planet called Anaris, which is a planet that has been inhabited by people who've left the nearby planet called Uras. They've left after a kind of uprising, a rebellion, and they've gone to inhabit and settle this other arid planet. And she then uses this as a way of, yeah, evolving this thought experiment as to, you know, what a plausible and I think likable utopia is. I mean, it's the only literary utopia that I've ever come across that I would leave planet Earth for. And I think that is quite a momentous achievement to achieve that on the page, because writing about better places, writing about utopias, is notoriously difficult.
Yeah, sure. I mean, but you even spent some time at this imagined utopian community, that of Aurobindo in India, but they don't enjoy describing themselves as a utopian society because that carries too much baggage, and you describe it as a living laboratory of alternatives. Please elaborate on that experience.
Yeah, so this community, it's just called Aurobindo. It was established in the late 1960s. It bills itself as one of the longest lasting international conscious cities. It's a very fascinating history. I sort of happened across it when traveling in South India. It's in Tamil Nadu. It's quite near to Chennai. You know, I just experienced it as a very, they don't like the word utopia because they feel it comes with too much baggage. But I experienced it as this kind of laboratory for social alternatives, different forms of education, organic farming, different kinds of architecture. And it's a very sort of low-key eco-feel. It's set in this forest, and it was the whole landscape was reforested over 50 years. So it went from being an arid canyon to being this beautifully reforested. It's a huge ecological restoration program as well. And then subsequently, I read a book by someone who'd grown up there called Akash Kapoor, which is called Better to Have Gone. It's this fascinating memoir of what it means to grow up in a community that has deliberately set itself apart from the wider world and trying to work towards something more idealistic. The interesting thing about Aurobindo is it's this kind of mixture of Indian traditions of thought and spirituality. And then also it sort of mixes with the post-1960s, 1970s, countercultural, I guess more Western sort of idea of utopia. And these two things fused quite literally in the two sort of figureheads of the project. One was a man called Aurobindo, who was from Bengal, and one was a woman who everyone calls the mother, who was originally sort of French Egyptian. And they sort of dreamed up this this community that's still going to this day, and you can visit it, and you can see all sorts of different low-key, quite sort of eco-minded but very intriguing social alternatives that they're trying to pioneer.
Hedley, what would your idea of a not sustainable or practically realizable utopia be?
Well, that's not a very fair question, Mila. I mean, you know, I guess the whole book is written to answer that question, and it's very difficult to put it on paper. You know, it's very difficult to put a better world on paper, and I sense I sort of refract the question in all kinds of different ways. So one goes into literature with Ursula Le Guin. In one, I'm visiting a real intentional community, to use the sort of technical term, in Aurobindo. But then in other ways, I'm taking the question of better worlds in, I suppose, less explicit or less traditional ways. I'm looking at friendship, looking at being young, constantly returning to a period of my life where I was not yet in the working world. I was sort of broke and bikepacking around the Scottish islands. And, you know, Scotland, for example, small country, and they have legislation where you're allowed to camp anywhere. There's free camping. So there's this sort of sense of right of access across the landscape that's so different to the South African experience. And, you know, I was traveling around on these islands, and they have these stone cottages that are called bothies. And the kind of code of conduct is that anyone's allowed to just pitch up and stay in these stone structures for free. There's no payment. So, you know, I found myself on this island. And I met a couple there. The woman was from Italy. The man was from Belgium. And they were like full on, you know, vegans, hardcore anarchists. They existed almost entirely outside the formal economy. And I spent this time with them on this island, and it was a kind of idyll because we didn't have to pay rent. We didn't have to pay to exist. You know, there's so many parts in this world where you just have to pay just to be. And then there's these pockets, like, I don't know, like libraries or certain places, paddling out to the back line in the ocean. You know, there's another essay, this is about surfing, where you can access a kind of, maybe just a glimpse of another a world that's different or organized differently to our own. And you know, just going back to the COVID experience, I think that COVID, it unleashed this very utopian energy, because suddenly, you know, for years we'd been told, oh, you can't shut down the global economy. Emissions can't come down. You know, things are as they are. There's no alternative. That's what Margaret Thatcher liked to say. You know, Margaret Thatcher and Ronald Reagan. There's no alternative to the social and economic structure of our world. Then COVID came, and suddenly the economy was shut down overnight. And, you know, it just sort of said, like, things don't have to be as they are. And we need to realize that things have been otherwise in human history. And they could be otherwise again, you know. So I think, to me, the vision of utopia that work towards is less like a place and more a way of thinking, a way of sort of denormalizing the sort of what we're asked to take as inevitable, you know, in the world today.
Mm-hmm. The ocean you mentioned, I mean, you started to learn how to surf when you were 36, if I'm not mistaken.
That's correct.
Yes. But the ocean does feature quite extensively throughout your collection as well. What does the ocean tell you about, I think, feeling alive and in the now, in the moment, if it does at all? Do you experience that?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, well, I mean, so the collection opens with this, I don't know, this memoir, this surf more of learning to surf way too late. You know, I mean, surfing is like one of those things, I guess, like skiing, or you really have to learn it when you're young, because it's so difficult. It's so counterintuitive. You always have to make the move that you least want to make. And for someone like me, I'm an only child, and I've got a very strong sense of like self-preservation. I'm very bad because I don't want to charge down an 8-foot wave. You know, I'm sort of, my body doesn't want to do it. So it's a very difficult pastime. And I suppose it's quite interesting as an adult to go and do something, to try and learn something that's really hard and that you're not very good at, you know. It's a good reminder of things. But of course, what it does bring is this contact with the ocean, which is, of course, South Africa's got an enormous coastline. The wonderful thing about surfing, in a sense, one of the most intriguing things about that whole process was just learning to have a different relationship with certain pockets of the ocean. Because, you know, what surfers are doing is they are understanding their local break, and they are beginning to understand the incredible, almost infinite array of conditions that play through the ocean and the wind and so on, and understanding winds and tides and swell and, you know, onshore, offshore, when a break is going to work, as they say, when it's going to fire, when there's going to be waves, when there's not. So you actually have to go into this very deep, almost technical scientific study of the ocean if you're going to want to get into surfing. So, you know, that was fascinating to me. Also, just the language of that pastime. It's a very, you know, surfers are like, they're a very sort of distinct clan. They don't like new people, because if you're a new person, you're going to be cluttering up breaks that the locals don't want you there, really. So it's a tough one, you know. I've got a friend who's also a climber and a surfer, and he said, your climbing's totally different because there's enough rock to go around. If you're climbing, you're not taking away someone's climb. But if you're surfing, you're often taking away their wave. So it's also this quite aggro, sometimes masculinist pastime. But what I tried to bring was a bit of a kind of comic take. And a lot of that was about learning to surf with one of my oldest friends. And I suppose the piece really became about male friendship in some ways, and the sort of, yeah, you know, the preservation and the valuing of friendships as you get older. Because as you get older, it does become harder to make friends or to keep friends. So, you know, strangely enough to me, it became this other kind of utopia of a kind of intimacy and shared experience between two middle-aged men. In that essay as well, I was totally obsessed with this book by William Finnegan called Barbarian Days, which won the Pulitzer. I mean, William Finnegan was an incredible surfer, an incredible writer, and he writes this memoir of his life and surfing. It is just, I've read it about five times. It's just overwhelmingly immersive and brilliant. And the funny thing was, about a year ago, I mean, he's an American, I bumped into him in my local bar in Power and the Glory. He was talking to Mikey February. I said, "Oh my God, are you William Finnegan?" So I actually met, having written that piece all about surfing and having admired this memoir by William Finnegan above almost all other writing on the subject, I ran into him in my local, and now we're kind of pen pals. He sends me pictures of all the waves he's surfing around the world. So it was an interesting ending to that story.
Yo, Grom no more. So utopias aside, you write about things like surfing, and you even touch on the friendship between Rudyard Kipling and Cecil John Rhodes. How did you go about deciding what to include in the selection of essays?
Yeah, well, that's quite a good question, because I remember auntie of mine, when my first essay collection came out, she said, "Yeah, I don't know, hey, you should just call it Random Collection." Because I've often thought of that, should have been my working title, Random Collection. No, so, you know, clearly they're all very different. But I think one of the, there's not many satisfying things about writing. I think it's generally a pretty dissatisfying process. But one of the satisfying things about writing a book like this is you begin to see how there are little echoes and reflections and linkages between the different pieces. So things get taken up, you know, it's almost in an unconscious way. You'll see something getting repeated, or something being echoed, or something. And I just hope that, even though the essays are all very different, and, you know, some of them are memoirs, some of them are stories, some of them are closer to kind of fiction, some of them are kind of about books and literature, I hope that there will be that sort of quite mysterious unity within them. I mean, the one about Rhodes, I was led by the nose, quite literally, because that was a sort of epic research project that I undertook to find the nose of Cecil Rhodes that was cut off the Rhodes Memorial on the slopes above UCT. It was angled ground off in about 2015. And, you know, I've always taught a short story in my day job as a literary prof. There's a story by the Russian writer Gogol about a man who wakes up and his nose has disappeared from his face. And he tries to find his nose in the streets of St. Petersburg. And it's this ridiculous story, because the nose is swanning about. It's having much more success with the ladies than its owner ever had. It's been promoted. It's wearing it's got a higher military rank. So he's kind of trying to chase his own nose. And so when these two things happened sort of within this close proximity to each other, I felt personally involved. I wondered, like, had I actually been implicated in the story by teaching this story and then the nose of Rhodes disappearing. So yeah, that was a kind of crazy investigative. I mean, I spent a number of years on that quest, and it took me into places that I never knew existed. And you know, it also showed you, which I think writing often shows you, that it's not what you, the world isn't what you think it is. Like, it wasn't. Mm-hmm. It wasn't, you might have, if you hear someone's ground off Rhodes' nose, you might have a certain picture of who that might be and why they were doing it. But like Gogol's story suggests, that the world is always weirder and more bizarre than you think. Mm-hmm. And that story, that imbroglio, that fiasco really took me into that world, yeah.
And how did you go about deciding how to structure the order of the essays? Because they're all, they're achronological. Firstly,
I spent a lot of time writing the titles on little slips of paper, and putting them on my wall and shuffling them and reshuffling them. You know, I have this theory about mixtapes. You know, I don't know, mixtapes aren't such a thing nowadays, but I'm going back to the days when you literally made mixtapes, you know, you had a 90-minute tape. And I used to obsess about the order of the tracks on a mixtape that I was giving someone, you know, and I would be like, this, it's so important. Like, what's the first track? Is this going to lead to that? And then, what's the logic? And on the one hand, you can spend your life thinking about that. And on the other hand, you can just put them in any order and they're going to create a logic. So it's kind of, you know, I, having shuffled those sheets of paper for like 2-3 years as the essay collection, you know, grew, I then submitted it to my editors and they said, no, we recommend this order. And then immediately I said, that's fine. You know, I can see the logic and it's out of my hands. So I went with their mix. And yeah, I think the one thing I was quite sure about was the last piece, because, you know, it ends on a particular note. I don't want to give too much away, but it ends with a phone ringing. It ends with a phone ringing on a phone box all alone on a misty, cold island far away. And I wanted that last image of this phone. If someone's phoned it just to hear it ring. And I love that image. And I just wanted that to ring into the space after the book had finished. Over and above that, you know, the sort of sequencing is sort of, yeah, I think there is a logic, but again, it's those sort of sometimes secret or implicit or non-obvious tendrils and tentacles and growths that are weaving between the different pieces, which I hope comes across to the reader, because I think within like a short story cycle or an essay cycle, that can be a very satisfying thing where you see those kind of non-obvious links between the pieces that are, as you say, not chronological and not in any sort of explicit order.
Yeah, because that's life, ultimately, actually. Also, stylistically speaking, your inclusion of the imagined utopian alphabet, I found that fascinating, or the imaginary utopian alphabet.
Yes. So, yeah, that was interesting to me because, you know, the word utopia was, of course, coined by Thomas More, who writes about this imagined island. He pretends that it's part of the New World, as Europeans are calling it. He like many utopian books, it's presented as a kind of hoax. It's presented as a kind of real travelogue with its own maps and its own alphabet. And part of the joke is that it's both very carefully imagined, but it's also impossible. You know, so utopia, as I think many people know, it's a pun, and it means good place. If we go for the EU spelling, like utopia, like eugenics and euphemism and euthanasia, good. But if you have it with the OU, utopia, it means nowhere land. It means no place, impossible place. So there's always this joke with utopias that they both have this realism to them and this kind of texture. And they also, you can point to them on a map. This is what Oscar Wilde said, you know, a map of the world always has to have utopia on it. You can point to a utopia on the map. It's got a topos, it's got a topography, but at the same time, it's advertising itself as impossible. So anyway, one of the sort of ways that Moore makes this hoax is to create this alphabet, utopian alphabet, which the people on his island are using. And I reread I'd read Utopia as an undergrad. I actually find it a very boring book, like many utopias, unfortunately. But I had another look at it, and I looked at this alphabet, and I'd just been in Kerala, which of course is a communist, it's a communist run state in India, and it's an incredible place. And there's like hammers and sickles next to the temples, and you know, and I'd been seeing the script there, Malayalam. And then I looked at the utopia and I thought, sheesh, you know, that looks, there's like a deja vu here. That utopian alphabet looks like Malayalam. And then I subsequently learned that Moore was very likely influenced by travelogues that were coming in after Vasco da Gama's rounding of the Cape, coming back to Antwerp, coming back to the cities where he wrote his text. And he was kind of borrowing, because utopia is also a very colonial sort of endeavor in some ways. He was borrowing this exotic alphabet. And so there was kind of a reason for this. But what I loved is that the designer of the book very cleverly lifted out that alphabet and used it as a kind of, you know, all the titles of the essays also appear in this utopian alphabet, which I thought was a, a lovely design touch. And I was really happy that the designer did that.
Yeah, no, it looked really cool. So good call, designer. Your title is drawn from a Leonard Cohen song. Can you just tell me a bit more about your affinity with Leonard and why this song specifically for Show Me the Play?
Yeah, so it's from one of Leonard Cohen's very late albums, you know, where his voice was super gravelly and the production was very simple. And they're almost quite mystical and religious. He's going back in those albums to almost a tradition of cantor singing in synagogues and so on. And I love his late work. And it was just this song. The line that I kept thinking of was, "The troubles came, I saved what I could save, a thread of light, a particle, a wave." And it spoke to me in the sense that, you know, we are facing an extraordinary troubled world across so many different sectors, environmentally, politically, culturally. And what are we going to put in our personal arc, in a way that you know, if we had to designate the few key fragments and artifacts and memories, you know, to put in to hold, that would hold value and beauty and meaning for us, what would that be? So I also love that, just the metaphors, a thread of light, a particle, a wave. It's almost like quantum. And it's almost, and also, you know, it goes to the questions of waves and swells that run through the piece. And yeah, I mean, I wrote to the Leonard Cohen estate asking for permission to use the line, you know, just from good manners. They never got back to me because I think Leonard Cohen's children are in a protracted legal battle with the manager of his estate. So they probably got other things to worry about, but we just went ahead. And I used the title. I just, you know, they show me the place in a sense of what is your place? What is each of our place where we go for sustenance, for nourishment, for value, for meaning, for beauty? What do we return to? What are the places? And those could be literal places, although sometimes it's dangerous to revisit a place, that you hold in your memory. And then it could be literary places. It could be the topos of utopia. It could be, what is that place? And can it be shown? Because there's also the sense of, you know, the difficulty of showing you a place, which is often in memory. It's often imaginary. It's maybe, you know, like so many utopias are, partly unrealizable. So it just seemed to condense a lot of the essays together, that title, and it just resonated with me. I don't know, you sometimes just get attached to a title early on and you cling to it like a life buoy, you know.
Agreed, I hear you totally. But now that you mentioned resonated, and I think I'm going to make this my last question actually. What most resonated with me in the literal sense of reading this book was your struggle to obtain your driver's license. So, Hedley, how many attempts did it take?
Yeah, it was radical, Mila. I mean, I failed and failed again over the course of something like close to a decade, you know. And I was between South Africa and I was living in Scotland at the time. And I would come home and desperately try to take it in South Africa and always fail miserably. And, you know, it had real consequences at that time for me, because, you know, that's taken from an essay where I'm writing about my mother, who suffered from an early form of dementia. And so there was the sense that because I was too useless to get my driver's license, we were kind of stuck in a kind of gated or a kind of holiday complex on the garden route. And it's like torture, you know, because we in South Africa, there's another difference between living between a place like Scotland and South Africa. In Scotland, you can make your way through cities and landscapes much more easily. There's more public transport, there's more access. But South Africa, as we know, it's an increasingly guarded and fortified place. And so, you know, if you're stuck in a kind of boom-gated community that's next to a highway, far, quite far away from town, you really are stuck there. So yeah, the failure of getting my driver's license, I then failed several more times in Scotland. It was very painful indeed. And I think because I took so long to get my driver's license, driving has never lost its sort of bizarre fascination for me. I find the whole practice of driving and the amount of time that we devote to it and the behaviors that it calls forth, I find them absolutely, they've never become normal for me. I think that was a legacy of this repeated failure from my 20s.
But well done, hey, on how it been, lot wheel.
Yeah, thank you.
So thank you so much for joining me today, Hedley, and all our listeners. Show Me the Place is now available at all good bookstores and online. So go give it a read.
Thanks for listening to this episode of PageCast. We love hearing from you. So if you'd like to get in touch, please contact us at pagecastpodcast@gmail.com. Until next time, keep reading and listening.